Good morning. Where does Representative Calvin Say live? A special committee will hear evidence this week based on a petition filed by attorney Lance Collins. He'll join us later this hour. And the relationship between pesticides and the development of children is at the heart of several measures up for hearing tomorrow. We'll talk with Janie Shelton of UC Davis. She's the lead researcher whose study is informing Hawaii's proposed legislation.
And Pharrell isn't the only guy to be happy. Hawaii Theater for Youth playwright Annie Cusick Wood will be here with her version for kids 3 and up, and that could include you. Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. It's not just in fanciful stories that people go painting in the open air. We'll get a preview from artist Ronaldo Macedo of the work set to show at the Maui Plein Air Painting Invitational.
All that starts in just a minute, but first, this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Hello there, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
I'm sitting here cold as you are because I'm watching you in that parka. Sometimes, you know, we talk about this a lot, but there are worse things that could be happening. And we're going to talk about something that might be happening depending upon how approximately close one might be to a place in which pesticides are being used. Now, you might remember that just before the current legislative session began, there was an informational briefing about the effects of pesticides on the development of children. The briefing laid the groundwork for several bills that would mandate notice and reporting of commercial pesticide use near sensitive areas. Those would be things like schools and hospitals and child care centers. One of the researchers to present findings is Janie Shelton, an epidemiologist and biostatistician from the University of California, Davis in the Department of Public Health. She was the lead author of a large multi-site California-based study that considered the associations between certain classes of pesticides and pregnant women exposed to them, and later the diagnoses of autism and developmental delay in their children. The Hawaii bills will be heard tomorrow. Janie Shelton joined us by phone today. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for making time for us. Some of the people got to see your presentation and the slides and things, that some of which we've uploaded to our Facebook page. But in general, if we can talk a little bit about how this study was done and really how close did you have to be to feel the effects of that, and some of the ways in which you see that maybe this might have import for Hawaii. So let's talk about what you did in California.
Sure. So in California, we used a database of pesticides that had been applied for agricultural purposes, and we mapped homes that were nearby to where those pesticides were applied. And those homes were for participants in a case control study of parents with children with autism and also developmental delay, and then also we have a control group to compare those cases to. So what we were able to find is that within about a mile of the home, we could detect some increased risk of having a child with autism from the applications of certain types of pesticides that fall into the organophosphate family.
Okay, and so before you go on there, so when you talk about increased risk, how much of a risk? What are we talking about here?
So for later in pregnancy, we saw about a threefold increased risk. Now, what that means is if 1 in 100 kids in the general population are diagnosed with autism, it means that mothers with this particular exposure, about 3 out of 100 would be diagnosed.
And specifically, I know you were talking, you're beginning to talk about the pesticides, but I wanted to make sure that we have some sense of what that threefold risk looked like. So the pesticides specifically were some of the same issue, some of the same pests, the organophosphates?
That's right, yeah. So we were looking into certain pesticides that are actually neurotoxins, and one of these is called chlorpyrifos, and this is a pesticide we're particularly interested in for neurodevelopmental effects from gestational exposure. And we were able to find an increased risk with that particular pesticide in California. Now, our study is not the first, actually, to report these associations. There's been two studies previously, also in California, to report associations with agricultural pesticides and autism spectrum disorders in children. And so while the information is not conclusive about the causal association, researchers are closely looking at this, and I know regulators are also concerned. And so coming to the Hawaii situation, of course, it's also very important to consider the buffer areas, as you mentioned, in these bills around schools and also residences.
In looking at the research, as you say, there's not this direct link or causality, but you see this as being evidence for those who are able to regulate to take more of an interest in a precautionary principle.
Exactly. That's right. Because, you know, while the research is slow to come forward, we still need to protect people against potentially damaging effects to the cognitive development of their children. And you know, autism and developmental disorders are something that are a little bit hard to diagnose. But when they do occur, when autism is diagnosed, it can be a really devastating diagnosis for that child and those families. And so our goal is really to do research that can prevent as many cases as possible. So out of the precautionary principle, just in the event that these pesticides do increase the risk of autism, in a causal way, we would want to prevent those exposures wherever possible.
As you look at Hawaii in the context of not only your research that came out last summer, but also the other studies that predate that, how do you see Hawaii's ability to grapple with this in terms of other places and other states?
You know, I think it's really important for Hawaii to take this step forward to protect the population, and particularly young people, because with the case of Hawaii, with such a long growing season, I mean, your agricultural growing season is pretty much year-round, as I understand, whereas in many, many other agricultural areas, you only have a brief growing season. Hawaii may have a much longer duration of potential exposure. And so in some cases, applicators may say, okay, well, it's summer, kids are out of school, so it's fine to spray these pesticides. Whereas in Hawaii, I wonder if pesticides are being applied more often throughout the year. And so that would give me some cause for concern, particularly for the Hawaii situation.
Duration of our growing season, and also the fact that, as you've mentioned, what may not be as clearly defined as on the mainland, is one thing. Do you also have any concern, given the fact that we are talking about a very small and finite landmass here as opposed to California?
Well, I mean, I don't think that would necessarily cause a greater cause for concern, but I do think that because you are probably in closer quarters with agricultural growing areas, this would be a concern. The closer you are, the more likely you are to be exposed to agricultural pesticides through drift, which has also been shown to potentially cause acute poisoning in schools and for children. So it's really important to have these buffer areas and to make sure we have enough distance between homes and agriculturally applied pesticides.
With such a small area, some people have said, would a buffer zone make a difference? I mean, is it still too close?
It depends on how large the buffer zone is. I think that I would promote a buffer zone of at least a mile, because this is where we were able to detect effects. And so while I'm not an expert in pesticide drift, I do know that there are a lot of factors that are involved in how far these pesticides can travel. And as a general rule of thumb, the greater distance that you have from these pesticides, the better. And they do degrade in sunlight over time. And so it's not something where, you know, previously in the 1960s and 70s, we were worried about pesticides that were persistent and they were not degrading in the environment. Current pesticides are actually degrading over time. So we do have that going for us.
Any plans to do any study looking at Hawaii, since it seems to be, in many cases, sort of, the nexus of so much discussion regarding pesticides?
You know, we would love to. I think that one of the most important things to get going on is data collection. So if you can, in support of these bills, if you can develop a system where there are mandatory reporting rules, that really helps people like me on the scientific investigation side go and do research about where these pesticides were applied, and then, you know, to follow children who are growing up in those areas. And that's how that research gets done. So if we don't have a reporting mechanism, it's really hard to know going back in time what people were exposed to.
Well, we'll see what happens if we get that reporting mechanism based on some of those bills that are going to be looked at tomorrow. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Janie Sheldon is an epidemiologist whose published work considers the risk factors for autism and developmental delay in children. Her research looks at environmental and demographic risk factors that could help explain the rise in autism throughout the United States. And her recent publications reported several pesticides which may increase the risk of autism following exposure during pregnancy. The joint hearings on Senate Bill 793, 1037, and 797 by the Committees on Health and Energy and the Environment. That's scheduled for tomorrow afternoon at 3 in Conference Room 414 at the Capitol.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Later in the show, Honolulu Theater for Youth takes on the ultimate subject, happiness itself. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an iconic house of worship in downtown Honolulu that was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1973. It opened in 1867 at Queen Emma Square, where Baratania and Queen Emma Streets converge. King Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma raised $30,000 to begin construction of the Honolulu Cathedral, and prefabricated sandstone blocks were brought to the islands for that purpose. They'd been to England a few years earlier, where they came under the influence of the Church of England. The newly built cathedral was created to be the seat of the Anglican Church in Hawaii, and the king died before construction was finished, but his brother and successor, Kamehameha V, took over the project and laid the cornerstone in honor of his predecessor on March 5, 1867. The cathedral is built in the French Gothic style, and it remains a Honolulu landmark, and by now, maybe you know what it is. If you can name it, call us. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and we'll come back a little later and tell you who got it right.
Good morning, I'm Konoe Morishige from the Nature Conservancy Marine Fellowship Program. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We learn so many important things when we're very young, and maybe the most important is how to be happy. So much of what will define us later takes shape in those early years, when it's so important to understand where the real sources of happiness can be found. Playwright Annie Cusick Wood has created a new play with that idea in mind. Happy is about to have its world premiere at the Honolulu Theater for Youth, and she's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I love this idea, but it's such a sort of a broad-reaching, ambitious idea. Was it daunting to work on this?
Oh, you're kidding me. It was the most daunting play I've ever had to do. And as soon as it came out of my mouth, it was like, all of a sudden, then that song, I can't believe you played that song this morning. Of course you did. It's a great song. But that song came after I had the idea.
Yeah.
And then everybody was like, oh, like the song. And I was like, no, not like the song. It wasn't about the song. It was about something else.
You were there
first. The idea came to me, and then all of a sudden it was a roller coaster. You know, because you still have to think a couple of years in advance to book, you know, to get the show ready.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden I was doing it, and I have to say, I felt this huge responsibility, you know, doing a show about happy.
Yeah.
I think you are, you know. People are like, really? And what are you saying? And are you giving the right message? And I was just like, oh my goodness. So it was, you know, it was a great exploration for all of us at HTY.
Well, you know, it seems like an idea that only really takes shape with us in adulthood. The whole notion that being happy in ourselves involves a lot of things that we do for and with others.
Yeah, that's right. And that is part of the message in the play. You know, there are two characters on their own, and, you know, they both enter the play at very different levels of happiness. What I learned in my process was that in my research, was that we all have a certain baseline of happiness, you know, so you might be a little bit generally happier than I am, but we can all complete 100% happiness by doing other things, that we have this different baseline. So I thought I'd have these characters. One was called Jolly and one was called Molly. And Jolly, of course, is a little bit more happy than Molly. And then to see where they went in the throughout the course of the play. And you know, they don't start off as friends or anything like that, and then the end they do. But it's not about that as well, because one thing I wanted to say in the play was that other people can't make you happy or make you sad, in fact. You know, it's up to you to take that responsibility on yourself. You know, I'm not saying that if you're with somebody who's giving you a miserable time you should stay. You know, we should all get out of the storm when it starts to rain.
Yeah.
You know, that we're not responsible for somebody else's happiness, and it's something that you have to find within yourself. There were so many layers of things that we could do, but, you know, we have a 35, 37-minute play, and I came to conclusion quite early on that I thought, this is the story about these two people, not about the whole world of happiness. We cannot, in 35 minutes, answer all these questions or even know them, you know. Who knows what the secret is? But I just wanted to give the kids a glimpse into some possibilities of what they could do to shift if they find themselves in a funk, which we often are in a funk, you know, and Molly is in a funk, you know, and she doesn't get out of her sad tent, but, you know, but she does eventually, and they go on this little journey, which is, you know, it's all about the journey, of course, and not where you're going to get to. So it was fun.
I imagine it was, but it also, it sounds as if, Annie, what you're saying is that even if your baseline of happiness isn't as much as someone else's, it's always within your reach, yeah?
Yes, definitely. That's what I discovered in my research, that there are different things that, you know, make up your happiness. What was surprising to me was that your environmental circumstances was a very small percentage.
Really?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, you can have, like, you know, the wealthiest person who lives in the beautiful beachfront Hawaii, and then somebody who lives in the slums of Kolkata. And in fact, a documentary I watched did have the guy sitting in the slums of Kolkata in a tiny shack going, oh, my house is great. It's so fantastic. I have tarp here and it stops the rain coming in, you know, in a really happy demeanor. And another key thing I learned, and this was when I discovered that actually at Harvard, they study happiness. Because somebody was like, oh, well, if we study depression and sadness, surely we should be studying happiness as well. And they said that the more things you do that make you happy, the better you become at becoming happy, at staying happy. So, for example, you know, like working out, does that make you happy? Yes. Do it every day, you'll be happier every day. You know, so doing positive things that make you happy, makes you happy. You know, it's not really that scientific, you know.
But, you know,
and of course, being grateful and not having others comes into that as well, you know, because that doesn't make you happy. But yeah, it was a huge responsibility taking on a subject like this. And, you know, the key thing in the play for me was that Molly and Jolly were waiting. They have tickets to go to a place called Happy, and they're waiting for this bus that, of course, doesn't come, because happiness isn't anywhere else but right here.
And it's not you don't necessarily take a bus to get there. You might already be there, right?
Did you say you bike?
No, I say a bus to get there.
A bus. Yeah, no, you don't get a bus, and the bus doesn't come for them. So really, it's about what they do when the bus continues to be later and later and later, and the bus conductor is kind of playing a game with them, you know, because of course there isn't a place called Happy that they're going to go to, you know, and it's when the bus doesn't come that they eventually go off to try and find it themselves and realize it was right here all along. They just had to stop waiting.
Well,
get
Annie,
on
it's
and do
a,
something.
It's a lovely lesson, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm glad as well. It was nice to touch base with you again.
Always. Annie Cusick-Wood is the author of Happy, a world premiere play for children ages 3 and older at the Honolulu Theater for Youth. The play opens this Saturday at Tenney Theater at the Cathedral of St. Andrew and runs through the end of the month. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hey, America, let's turn it up. Yeah, check out our styles. You know you're never fully dressed without a smile. Your clothes may be Chanel, Gucci, your shoes crocodile. Baby, you're never fully dressed without a smile. And if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for it all. We got all we need, got nothing more. Never fully dressed without a smile. And if you stand for something, you can have it all. If it's real, you'll love and never do. Never fully dressed without a smile.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m., right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio brings you in-depth reporting from sources around the globe and from our own award-winning news team, the largest radio newsroom in Hawaii. We thank well-informed listeners Hal Glatzer and Kathy Frankovic of Hilo, Edward Shipwright of Honolulu, and Charles and Susan Gall of Kailua for choosing to support this station with their membership. Make your HPR your current affair. Become a member today by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can visit hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Masters of Public Administration program at UH Manoa, featuring evening classes for working professionals. Now accepting applications. Learn more at puba.hawaii.edu.
Here's a question for you. What happened to the American dream of owning a home? Maybe it's a question you've asked yourself. As middle-class Hawaii struggles to find the answer, some are wondering if the trade-offs are worth it. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair reports on a reality check based on their series, Living Hawaii. Chad, good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, this story keeps getting better and better about how much we can't afford by living here and asking ourselves the question, so why are we living here?
Or rather, can we afford to live here, and what can we do about it? In our latest installment, Eric Pape, with the help of our intern, and by the way, Marina Riker, they went and they looked at a median family income here on Oahu. How far is that going to get you when you factor in all the basic expenses? Well, guess what? It's not going to get you very far. In fact, you're probably going to go in debt just trying to meet those basic living expenses to get by.
Okay, so let's talk about what that median family income is, because after taxes, if
right.
we talk about a median family income of $78,000,
right.
a little over that, which is what you're quoting here in the article, on the mainland, that's okay.
You would do quite well. When we say median family income, we mean for a family of four. If you were living on the mainland, in many places you'd be paying 1/4 the cost of housing here on Oahu. But consider these other expenses, and Eric and Marina actually went in and listed them. So if you're going to factor in a mortgage, that's 28 grand right there. If you're going to include food, because you got to eat, right? There's going to be $17,000 there. Two cars, that's $8,200. And then utilities, about $3,700. These are annual expenses. Well, once you add all that up, guess where that $78,000 has gone? It's gone into the red. You've actually got a deficit of $653 every year.
And you didn't even mention anything about child expenses. If
child
you have
care.
Child care, if you have kids in school, any of that, that's not even factored into that yet.
Oh, not only that, guess what else is not in there? We're not including cell phones. I mean, gosh, how can you get by without a cell phone? Cable, the internet, clothing. I mean, how can you not factor in clothing expenses, car payments, student loans? We're not considering these basic expenses, and so we didn't include them in the original count. But to many of us, they are, in fact, a part of our existence.
So at this point, you know that if you're going to have basic expenses, and if you don't make $78,400-ish, that you're going to go into the red, which isn't a very hopeful situation, as we've been talking about for decades and decades, whatever those figures may be, for people who are struggling to be in the middle class and stay there.
You know, I think one of the main points of the series, and there will be more installments to come, is why are things this way and what can we do about that? And one thing that Eric is looking for is if you out there in listener land, radio land, have a story to share about struggling to get by or how you've maybe made some success in that regard, or you want to join us on Facebook, you can email Eric with your stories. We want to hear those stories and share them, hopefully to make it all a little bit more tolerable to live in this wonderful place we call home.
Yeah, sometimes we are our own best experts, and we need to look back to ourselves. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're welcome. Okay.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, there's a lot of effort in the tech community toward the startup companies, yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, we're going to cover something that perhaps doesn't get as much coverage in terms of some of the startups that are getting their kickstart. You know, we often think of these sort of internet startups, but, you know, there's a bunch of companies that actually have based their activity around research and development. So maybe some intellectual property came out of UH, or maybe, you know, some hired PhDs are researching something that could be anywhere from, you know, like the energy field or biotech or agriculture. And that R&D, you can actually get something called SBIR funding, which is Small Business Innovation and Research funding from the federal government, if your project sort of meets certain departments' interests, like maybe it could be Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, Department of Defense, and if there's projects within those agencies that your research might be applicable toward, they will fund you a phase one, phase two, or phase three for SBIR. So we'll talk a little bit about what that SBIR process is and what some of the companies are doing to, you know, sort of attract some of that funding. And one of the agencies here called the High Tech Development Corporation, they actually help administer the SBIR program. So if any, you know, sort of startups or people that are interested in doing some R&D activity, they have an interesting project, they might want to get it funded, you know, SBIR might be the way to go.
Sounds like it might. There's some pretty exciting possibilities there. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from the Cole Academy Child Development Centers. Enrollment available for ages 6 weeks to 6 years. Locations downtown, West Oahu, East Oahu, Kailua, Kapolei, and now open in Mililani. TheColeAcademy.com. Hey.
Where does Calvin Say live? The longtime representative has maintained that he lives in the district he represents. Six residents say just the opposite. The controversy led to a decision last December by a circuit court judge that the House itself would have to investigate to see if Say is qualified to serve. And while there is also a Hawaii Supreme Court challenge to that opinion, this Friday, a special House committee will hear testimony based on a petition that started last year and was filed last month by attorney Lance Collins, who joins us right now. Good morning.
Aloha. Good morning.
This question of where does Calvin Say live? This is a question that's been asked for years and years and years and years. It's a simple question if you look at it, and yet it seems to have so many complicated answers.
Well, it's Mr. Say has been in office for 40 years, and it seems that at least for the last 30, this is a question that's sort of been haunting him. Hopefully it comes to a meaningful resolution sometime soon.
Do you think that's possible? I mean, here we've asked this question for a long time, and some of the charges, and the same people who've been asking for a long time are not necessarily the people who are asking it this time. It's skipping along a little bit, but the same question comes back.
It's the same question over the years. The challenges have been different. Different people have challenged his voter registration, which has always been denied by the city government. This present challenge by the voters that I represent was a direct challenge to his privilege to hold office or to serve office in office, and that was taken to the courts, and it's working its way through the courts. But as you noted, the House intervened last year and said that they have the power to decide, and so now it's before the House, and I guess they may be exercising their power.
Well, I mean, that's what the circuit court judge said, is that, you know, they're going to have to kick it back to the House to see if they're going to investigate one of their own and judge whether or not he's fit to serve. But that puts those folks in the House, six members of that committee, into a very difficult position. The case has been made, well, you know, they don't know him very well. They're sort of, you know, newbies in some of this. Maybe that's not entirely true, but the idea of having to look into one of your own and make a judgment about that is both uncomfortable and, in many cases, in a situation like this, necessary, isn't it?
Well, you know, all institutions have this issue. Some of them in the past have not done a very good job of policing their own, like the Catholic Church with child molestation cases. But as we can see, when the people who make up an institution do not police their own, it ends up corroding the legitimacy and the credibility of and the integrity of an institution. And so, although it puts them in an awkward position, if they can rise to the challenge and meet it with integrity and dignity, then I think that the House in the end will be in a much better position than if it just gets swept under the rug.
With the way many people, and based on many polls that we've seen and talked about on this program and others, have said, we tend to look at our government and have a great deal of distrust in our government. This seems to be an opportunity to put some of that by and be able to say that, well, no, in fact, here's government working far better than you perhaps had thought it.
Yeah, well, the way the rules of this particular committee work, unfortunately, Friday we won't be able to present any testimony. All of the evidence gathering and investigating is for the committee itself, and this hearing on Friday will only allow my clients and Mr. Say 20 minutes each to make a statement, make argument to the committee, and to answer questions, almost like an appellate oral argument. And then the rest of the investigating is going to be done by the committee, and I don't know if that will be public or not, but certainly their report is going to really determine whether or not they've sort of are helping the public accept their legitimacy, or if it's just going to be this sort of thing where, well, we don't really care what the rules are, they don't apply to us.
Are you concerned that so much of this may be done behind closed doors?
Well, I hope not. but that's always a possibility. The legislature, of course, operates based on its rules and customs, and there's no rule that prohibits sort of these backroom dealings, and it is their custom to do that at times. So it is something as somebody who represents these people is concerned about in terms of fairness. But again, it goes back to, you know, that whatever this committee does and whatever it presents to the House and what the House does will reflect on the legitimacy and the integrity of the House as a whole. And so it's my hope that they have that in at the forefront of their minds when they're engaging in any activities, so that they engage in the highest ethical and legitimate conduct.
Do you think that House members think about that in terms of, well, this could potentially be me if I don't deal as ethically and as well as I could to represent the district I'm supposed to represent, and that they see themselves as being part of this and not just external to it?
Well, I hope so. But of course, on the other hand, I also hope that all of the people on the committee live in the districts that they represent.
Well, I don't mean to say from the living part of it, but just really the underpinning of it, which is to say that if you want to have a body that is representing itself well, that has the integrity and has the, you know, some credit attached to it and credibility attached to it, then really understanding that the whole is only as good as that old expression goes, as the weakest link.
That's right. Yeah, well, so in that respect, I'm familiar with all of the members of the committee. I think I was at Kaleo at the same time that Beth Fukumoto Chang was. I feel like all of the individuals do have integrity, and that they will do their duty.
And take this seriously.
And take this seriously. But of course, as you mentioned, there's all of this sort of backroom cloak and dagger stuff going on. And that's something that, you know, I'm not so familiar with them that how would they deal with that if the powers that be really try to exert pressure in the background. So that is a concern.
No matter what happens with this special committee, as you look to the Supreme Court decision, do you have any sort of weighting about what is going to mean more to you? I mean, obviously, a Supreme Court decision is pretty weighty, but as you look at the whole issue,
well,
putting an end to it.
The case law in Hawaii is that it's the courts that have the final determination over the interpretation of the Constitution. So if this committee makes some determination that says that blue is green or up is down, it would be for the Supreme Court to say no, that is not correct. And that is the role of courts in our society, that you can't democratically say something that is not real is real. With respect to interpreting the Constitution, the legislature cannot change the requirements of the Constitution simply by allowing someone who's not qualified to be in office.
Which is to say that perhaps depending upon what comes out of this committee, we still won't have an answer.
Quite possibly.
All right. We're going to leave it there and see what happens. Thank you for coming in, Lance.
Thank you.
Lance Collins is the attorney who submitted the petition asking whether or not Calvin Tsai is living in his district.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a historic building in downtown Honolulu that's on the National Register of Historic Places. It was conceived as the seat of the Anglican Church in Hawaii by King Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma, who had become followers of that faith during a visit to England. It was designed in the French Gothic style by two English architects, William Slater and R.H. Carpenter, and opened in 1867. One distinctive feature was added in 1958 when a huge stained glass mural was installed across the front of the church. The mural represents the history of Christianity and includes images of King Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma. Kamehameha IV did not live to see construction completed. He died in 1863 on the feast day of St. Andrew. We asked you for the name of this historic landmark, and that's your clue. The answer to today's quiz is the Cathedral of St. Andrew, named to honor the king's memory.
And there were several people who knew that. Jamie Crawford called us from Honolulu. Also, Mildred Rum called in to say, yes, that was the answer. Thanks to both of you. See, we got smart, smart, wonderful people who listen. Thanks so much for your call. And that's today's quiz. If you have a backyard quiz for us, though, you can send that in, too. It's at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That's where to send it, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Steve Shiraki from the Hawaii State Department of Education. You are tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Plein air painters are used to working against the clock. After all, they're trying to capture an image that's continually changing in front of them. Their art calls for a special set of skills that'll be on display this coming week on Maui when plein air specialists converge on the Valley Isle to take part in the 10th annual Maui Plein Air Painting Invitational. Ronaldo Macedo is a participating artist, one of the event's founders, and he joins us by phone from his studio. Good morning, Ronaldo.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, I always wonder how you folks do it, because every time you look up, the thing you're looking at is different, right?
Especially the light is different. Usually the scene is, you know, stays the same, but the light does change and the shadows change, yes.
And as those shadows change, how do you decide which version of the light, you know, which movement of the light you want to keep as your finished product?
Well, usually, you know, the usual approach is you record your shadows as fast as possible. So if they recede or if they elongate, you got an initial composition with the shadows and you kind of leave it alone. You don't keep chasing it. So if you start that way, then, you know, usually the sky and some other things kind of stay the same. But the shadows definitely are the ones that will change. And then your lights or your highlights, I'll just be added on later, but if you want to record them in the beginning as well, that helps also.
So there's really, you have to kind of approach each canvas, I would think, with almost a strategy of what to do first, what to do next, that kind of thing, huh?
Yeah, you do, especially if you're painting early in the morning or late in the afternoon. If you're painting in the middle of the day, things don't change as dramatically, or if you're painting on a cloudy day, things don't change, so you have a lot more time, and you can usually tell that the artist, that, you know, when you come across an artist painting on location on a gray day or on the middle of the day, they usually have a little bit more time to talk to you and kind of take time off the painting.
Sure, but you know, I know certainly photographers go for that. The first couple of hours of the day and the last couple of hours, the magic hours, because of the way the light is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's usually the most exciting time for us to paint. The morning does, it can have that golden effect, but I think the sunsets, the afternoon light between 4 and 6 here in Hawaii are pretty golden. The morning has a little bit more coolness to it, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a very, you know, usually it's a really clear light, and it is. It's probably the most exciting time of the morning to paint, like between 6:37 to about 9 o'clock, 9:30.
I see a lot more blue in that early morning light as opposed to late afternoon light, more orange and gold with the sunset. I don't know why that is.
I think so, too. I think that a lot of times here in Hawaii in the mornings, the sky is a little bit more clear because the clouds have kind of dissipated overnight.
Yeah.
And I think the light filtering through is a lot more clear. And as the clouds build during the day, things get a little bit more, you know, more dramatic.
I've also, Ronaldo, just looking at skylines in recent weeks, especially seen a big difference between a day when there's a lot of fog and a day after a heavy rain, which seems to have cleared it out of the sky.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, all over the country or the world, you have conditions that change like that. But here in Hawaii, I think I feel really gifted because you do have regular trade wind pattern days, and then you have these winter vog days. And usually the vog kind of it's before a cold front comes through. So in a couple of days, it'd be painting kind of this warm orange light. And then the front comes through, and you get this really crisp, clear air with the north winds, you know. And so, like within 1 week, you can have really, really different kind of paintings.
Yeah, one has a kind of a diffuse, almost like a diffusion filter look, and the other is crystal clear. Big difference, yeah.
Yeah, that's something that the mainland has more to offer. We call it atmosphere, and here in Hawaii, when everything is really clear, you can look across from Lahaina across to Molokai or Lanai, and you can see a lot of detail on the island when it's clear. And when there's a little bit more fog in the sky, it really goes back in space. And so when things go back in space, it does give the artist, you know, more to play with. When things are really clear, the artist almost has to invent a little bit of a space, kind of differentiate the layers as they go into the distance. And in the mainland, people get that more naturally, you know, because there's more pollution in the air.
Yeah.
So it's more common, yeah.
Well, you know, all the things you're saying to me, Ronaldo, really speak to a very detailed practice of observation before you've even put a brush to the canvas, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I've been painting since I was about 17 in oils. I've been painting in oils since about 17. And I have gone to school. I did go to college and major in art. So I'm kind of used to studying and used to getting together with other fellow artists and talking about, you know, how to approach things, how to deal with different light, how to deal with different challenges. And it's a really ongoing learning situation.
Sure.
And every time we go out, you know, you're always challenged by something. And sometimes you do a great painting and you're really excited. And sometimes you're really humbled. You know, you go out and you just get kicked, you know. And it's a really, you come back to the studio with this terrible painting. But there's a really big lesson, you know, has taken place. So
you have to just get back out there, and in part, I guess conditions dictate your result. Yeah.
Yeah, conditions, and also you know the elements around the town. You know, if you're setting up, you may be setting up to paint a beach scene, and it just happens that day there's a big party at the beach, and they put up a big tent, you know, covering the whole area that you're about to paint. Or you're about to paint a boat at the harbor, and all of a sudden the boat leaves, or a big boat comes in front. So there's a lot of challenges besides the weather that we encounter, and you just deal with it, you know.
Keeps you alert, I bet, Ronaldo. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you.
Ronaldo Macedo is a participating artist in and one of the founders of the 10th Annual Maui Plein Air Painting Invitational, which starts Sunday and runs for a week at several locations, including the Lahaina Jodo Mission, Montage Kapalua Bay, and Pioneer Inn. You can get details through our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Want to die.
A lot of times we're doing things to people that we wouldn't do to a terrorist.
Let's just keep her alive.
Paralyzing somebody when you put a person on a ventilator.
Turns out when researchers ask doctors that question, the answers they give are very different.
They'll turn to me in the ICU and they say, if you find me like this, kill me. And they're not kidding.
How Doctors Want to Die on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10, following The Splendid Table.
But then I have to wonder how this ongoing story about where Calvin Say does or does not live, how it looks to somebody who isn't familiar with the Hawaii political scene and the vagaries thereof. It's a strange story.
Well, they might just say, what? You can't look him up and see where his address is.
How hard can it be, right?
Well, but that's being facetious with that. But having this simple question, not having an answer over so long, whatever the answer is, it's just, could we have one, please?
And it's not the only time questions like that have arisen about a public official. And there's a deeper question of how much do the rules mean to them?
And that was what I think Lance Collins, the attorney who brought the petition to the House, has been saying, really, is that, is this going to be a mechanism for getting back some of that credibility? I mean, we know how people don't really have a great deal of trust in government. Might this be a vehicle to be able to prove that maybe there's a little bit that's been earned?
And the irony of those who make the rules not following rules is worth observing, too.
Well, we'll see which rules apply and what the final dispensation of that question really is, or at least getting the answer, hopefully sometime soon. That's going to do it for us today. Going up for tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the Women's Caucus bills. Senator Roz Baker will be here.
And Valentine's music performed live in our studio with special guest Melody Soul.
If you've got a conversation we should hear, you can let us know on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. Email's good, too. TalkBack@HawaiiPublicRadio.org is the address.
And you can hear today's show again at HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning for another run of The Conversation. Take good care. We'll talk to you then.